Welcome to Sabbath School, brought to you by It Is Written. We are studying the Bible this quarter, the book of Isaiah. This is a great study. We're up to lesson 7, the defeat of the Assyrians. These lessons are written by Dr. Roy Gain, who is a professor at the Theological Seminary at Andrews University in the areas of Hebrew Bible and ancient Near Eastern languages. Dr. Gain, thanks for being part of Sabbath School. I really appreciate you taking your time.
Thank you, Pastor Bradshaw. Delighted to be here.
I'm glad you are. These are terrific lessons. I'm thrilled you wrote them. I'm going to read the memory text. O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth. Defeat of the Assyrians, but along the way, some funny old things happen. Strings attached. This is Sunday, Isaiah 36, 1 is the verse listed. The question is asked, what happened to Judah? Now, it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defensed cities of Judah and took them. Give us the background. Tell us what's going on here and how it plays into the flow of the book of Isaiah where God is leading us.
There is a reason why this happened, because Sennacherib's father was Sargon II. Sargon II was a very powerful ruler, but he was killed in battle on a distant battlefield, which was viewed as a terrible thing, a very bad curse or whatever. And then there was going to be a transition, of course, in the leadership. Hezekiah wanted to be free from underneath the Assyrian yoke, because ever since Manasseh, Ahaz, had sent this bribe, a large bribe, to King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria, which included a lot of treasure from the temple, by the way, then the Assyrians regarded Judah as under their protection. They were not a province, as northern Israel was and as Syria was, but they were under protection of Assyria. So Assyria really expected and demanded something we could call tribute. That is a large gift every year. Now, at this point, when Sargon II was killed on a distant battlefield, Hezekiah saw an opportunity. We're going to get rid of this Assyrian obligation. And so that way we don't have to pay this obligation to the Assyrians, and we don't want them interfering with us anyway. And so Hezekiah realized that he was going to have some support. So he kind of got the small countries around about him to cooperate with him. So he was a ringleader of a rebellion against Assyria. And so when Sargon II died, the son of this king became the ruler, and his name was Sennacherib. Sennacherib, then, Hezekiah and his allies thought, was going to take a while in order to be able to come at them, and he was going to be a bit weaker maybe than his father, and they would have a chance to be free, and they would be able to face him in battle altogether. Well, it didn't work out that way, because Sennacherib turned out to be a very vigorous and able ruler. And within quite a short time, he cleaned up on the rebellions in the east, because when his father died, just about everybody, a lot of different kingdoms that were under this empire rebelled. They saw the opportunity, so they jumped. But he turned to the east, and he cleaned up on them and got them under control, and then he threw all the might of the Assyrian army against Judah. Now, Judah was in trouble, in very deep trouble. And in fact, it says that in the passages here in Kings and Chronicles and so on, and also in the Assyrian annals of Sennacherib, it makes clear that he came and invaded Judah, and he took all of Judah except for the city of Jerusalem, and he besieged Jerusalem. So that's all that's left of the kingdom of Judah, is Jerusalem, this one city, by far the biggest city. But still, it was a very small area. And we have, fascinatingly, the account by Sennacherib, as I mentioned, in his annals, which says he went up and he besieged 46 and captured 46 of the walled cities of Judah, besides innumerable little towns, and he deported a bunch of people and so on. So then he turned against the city of Lachish. Lachish was a fortress city not too far from Jerusalem, and there was a siege there You can see the siege depicted in the British Museum. There are wall reliefs from the palace of Sennacherib. Now, reliefs are pictures that are three-dimensional, so it's carving into this stone or whatever the material is, and it's giving pictures of what happens. And so these are pictures that I referred to in the introduction to the lesson here in the quarterly. It's very, very sad. These people were starving, and then when the city of Lachish fell as a result of the Persian battering rams and digging tunnels and ladders and everything like that, with the people trying to defend themselves by throwing firebrands over and shooting down and throwing stones and all the rest of it, the Assyrians still took the city. And when they did, they deported the people. And I didn't mention, I think in the quarterly, perhaps it's too gruesome, but you can see pictures in the British Museum that were from the Assyrians of the leaders of the city being impaled on sticks, you know, with their bodies, with these poles going through their guts and everything like that. And there are also there in the British Museum depictions of the Assyrian soldiers counting skulls. So they have skulls piled up like cannonballs, and they're counting these things. So it's really a very terrible thing what happened. And so this is the background that Sennacherib rebelled. He wanted to be free, but King Hezekiah rebelled, wanted to be free from Sennacherib, but then he was attacked and in this very, very bad situation.
It's interesting you point out the brutality. Not long ago, there was a major article from a pretty weighty publication talking about the artwork of the Assyrians and what it depicted. They were brutal. Little wonder Jonah was not thrilled with the idea of going to Nineveh, because these were horrible people who did the most ghastly things. So it's fascinating that some of that artwork can be seen today and has been preserved. They were not only brutal, but they were shrewd. As you bring out in Monday's lesson, propaganda, what arguments did the Rabshakeh use to intimidate Judah? So what was going on there? There was really a campaign, but now they went from force to, well, mind games. Why'd they do that, do you think?
Well, the Assyrians realized that it was economical if they could intimidate someone and just get them to surrender. That's a lot cheaper than a siege. A siege is very expensive. You can lose soldiers. It takes a lot of time, manpower. If you can just intimidate them into surrendering, take over, deport them, whatever, take their treasure, and then you move on, it's very efficient. This is something that they wanted to do. So the king of Assyria sent, according to Isaiah 36, verse 2, and this whole account parallels the one in 2 Kings, by the way, sent the Rabshakeh. Rabshakeh means the great one of the drink, or basically. So he's a chief butler. He's a chief drink server, like Nehemiah was later in the Persian court. But he's also a very, very high official. That was just a title, an honorific title. And he sent him from where? From Lachish, the same city that I told you about, that we have the depictions of the conquest of Lachish. And this is no accident, because the people knew what was going on at Lachish, and he could tell them what's going on there. And he came to Hezekiah Jerusalem, and he stood by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field. Where have we seen that before in Isaiah? We saw that before in Isaiah 7. This is the place where Ahaz was going to investigate the water supply for a siege. And so this is just outside the city, and this is where Isaiah met Ahaz back in chapter 7.
Yeah, that's a fascinating parallel there, isn't it? That's really very interesting. Hezekiah knew what to do. In a situation like this, he was confronted by overwhelming odds. His prayer is recorded, and I want to read this in Isaiah 37, starting in verse 15. He prayed to the Lord, saying, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, that dwellest between the cherubims, thou art the God, even thou alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see and hear all the words of Sennacherib, which hath sent to reproach the living God. Of a truth, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their countries, and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they've destroyed them. Now therefore, O Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art the Lord, even thou only. It's really interesting to me that as he called out to God, he appealed to God and said, we are jealous for your honor. Of course, he wanted to be preserved, preserve us, but he was saying, we want the world to know that you are the God, so the one true God. So behind all of this, there was this continual battle of the gods, really, wasn't there. Whose gods are the most powerful? This fellow knew that the other gods were no gods, but he was appealing to God to step forward and show himself to be who he really is. I believe that if we prayed like that, Lord, I want to see you glorified. Lord, we want to see you lifted up. We want to see you vindicated. We might see God do even more. But that was a really fascinating thing that he prayed, and God was with him, shaken but not forsaken. What do you make of this encounter, this passage in the book of Isaiah?
Well, this is marvelous because, first of all, Sennacherib with his army heard a rumor that someone was coming from the south, and they went to they had to withdraw. But the message came back from Sennacherib, delivered to Hezekiah, that that Sennacherib was coming back, and so don't feel secure. He's going to come back and he's going to take over. So you really should surrender. And so this was very intimidating. And Hezekiah went, and I love what he did in verse 14. He spread it out before the Lord. He spread out the letter from the Assyrian messengers, from Sennacherib. He spread it out before the Lord. Here it is. Here's the item. This is what I'm dealing with, Lord. Okay? So it's very specific. And then he prays this prayer. When he says enthroned above the cherubim, you realize that in the ark, that is in the sanctuary above the ark and between the cherubim, God was enthroned. And we find this language in the book of Samuel, where God is enthroned above the cherubim. And already in Exodus 25, it says that God would speak to Moses from above the ark. And so what he's really referring to is, Lord, you who are there in the temple, he's addressing it very specifically, you're dwelling with us. And then he is addressing the issue of God's honor, which is fascinating. And it's really in parallel in a way to the attitude of Job. Job said, though he slay me, referring to God, yet will I trust in him. And he said, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that I'm going to see him as a result. I know that my Redeemer lives, and because of that, I will, in my flesh, I will see God. So the important thing is not that I live. The important thing is about God. And when we focus on him and his honor and trusting in him, we may die, like John the Baptist died, like many other martyrs have died. And that is only the first death, which is like sleep. But he has our DNA in his database, and he's able to raise us again. I know that he is going to raise me again. So Hezekiah is focusing on what he should be focusing on, and that's a wonderful cry of faith there. And really, the result was amazing, because he's saying, God, Sennacherib is trying to mock you. It's like what David says to Goliath, and it's very much a David and Goliath situation, isn't it? David says to Goliath, you're mocking the living God. Here's the living God right here, parallel with that story of David and Goliath. And how does God like being mocked, being the living God? He's going to do something about that, and he did.
Yeah, he did. One thing that I think is really important for us to remember, you get into a jam sometimes and you say, how am I going to get out of this? You're up against opposition. There's an enemy. Satan is tempting you. You're caught. It feels like you're between a rock and a hard place. And you may be tempted to say, there's no way out. Interesting how God got them out of this. Behold, I will send a blast upon him. He shall hear a rumor. A rumor. Judah was delivered by a rumor. There was a marauding army. They said, oh, wait, we've got to go and tend to something. They turned around and got out. Deliverance came. God can get you out of anything, any old way he wants. He's 1,000 ways to provide for us, of which we know nothing. He delivered them by a rumor. Not a shot was fired. These are great faith-building stories, and we will be back with more in a moment. Lesson 7, Defeat of the Assyrians, Isaiah. This is Sabbath School, brought to you by It Is Written.
More and more people are watching It Is Written TV. They're watching their favorite It Is Written programs, listening to inspiring sermon series, and much more. They're watching them here, and even here. See for yourself why people are turning to It Is Written TV to watch their favorite Christian programs live and on demand. Watch It Is Written TV for free anytime on Roku, Apple TV, and at itiswritten.tv.
Welcome back to Sabbath School, brought to you by It Is Written. My guest is Dr. Roy Gain from the Theological Seminary at Andrews University. He is the author of this quarter's quarterly on the subject of, or on the book of, Isaiah. These are great, great lessons. Wednesday, the rest of the story. Hezekiah is king of Judah. Sennacherib, the king of the Assyrians, is coming against him. He turns around and takes off because a rumor is heard. He's got to take care of business somewhere else. But the Assyrians come back. And the rest of the story, I'm going to cook it down to this one little passage in where do you begin? I'll read verse 35, where the Bible says, God says, I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. There's a lot there. Verse 36, then the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, not those who'd been smitten, behold, they were all dead corpses. Dr. Gain, I want to hear from you about how you look at this and would summarize this phenomenal deliverance from for Judah granted by God. How do we analyze this best?
Well, I studied this passage at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, taught in modern Hebrew, the class was, by Moshe Weinfeld, a great Israeli scholar, who didn't, I'm not sure, but I didn't get the impression that he necessarily believes in miracles. Okay, a lot of scholars, critical scholars, and he was a critical scholar, do not believe in miracles by God, that God intervenes in human history in that way. And yet, when we got to this story, he mentioned that something unusual had to have happened, something really unusual. If you just take the Assyrian evidence, you look at Sennacherib's annals. I've read these annals in the Akkadian language, which is the original. We teach that. That's part of my class here. And in fact, deciphered an older version of part of his annals at Nineveh when my wife and I were digging there. And there was a little fragment, a little prism that was part of his annals. So this is stuff that we have access to. But what Sennacherib didn't tell is the rest of the story. You know about John Harvey's rest of the story? He's got a whole series and he has books like that. Wonderful. The rest of what happens. He doesn't tell the rest of the story. For Sennacherib, it was victory. He deported a bunch of people. He took a bunch of tribute. And Hezekiah did give him a big amount of wealth in order to sort of get him to leave and that kind of stuff. And so Sennacherib, if you read his annals, it looks like he won. Okay? But you don't hear the rest of the story, which is here in the Bible. Now, in our class in Jerusalem with Moshe Weinfeld, it was very clear, he understood from the evidence, and our class understood, that there was no way at this particular time in history that a ringleader of a revolt against Neo-Assyria at the height of its power was going to survive. Assyria was going to conquer that city. They were going to besiege it. They were going to take it. They were going to take the ringleader, who in this case was Hezekiah, and they were going to do very bad things to him, very bad things, put him to death in a very painful way. That's what the Assyrians did. And there is absolutely no way he's going to escape because they were a superpower. They could do anything they want. I mean, it's like the United States attacking a small country. The United States is going to win. It's just going to happen, okay? But the reality is we know from the ancient Assyrian records, that Assyria did not take Jerusalem. And that's why in the palace of Sennacherib at Nineveh, called Palace Without a Rival, you know, he could have called it Sennacherib Tower, Palace Without a Rival, he depicted the fall of Lachish, not Jerusalem. He should have depicted the fall of Jerusalem because that's the prize he was after, much bigger city. But it's not there. And so he depicts the smaller city. And there, those depictions being so gruesome and gory, that was the point of it. They wanted people who came in to see the king, to see what would happen to them if they revolted against Assyria. But we have what my wife and I, in a presentation, call a tale of two cities. The two cities were Lachish and Jerusalem, tale of two cities. It should have been Jerusalem there on the walls of the palace, but it was Lachish. And so this shows that something very unusual happened. And this explains it right here. This explains it. And really nothing less would really accomplish the result. 185,000 dead Assyrians. God did intervene. There was a miracle. And the critical scholars are allowing for that, but they're saying something weird happened, something weird, something unusual. We don't know what it is, but you know, they don't necessarily believe in this miracle here, but I do. I believe this is what happened.
Yeah, that was unusual, all right. I want to read from the lesson because I think this is really important. Because people will wrestle with this, 185,000 people dead. What kind of God are we dealing with here? Who would do such a thing? Hold on a minute. If Sennacherib had conquered Jerusalem, he would have deported the population in such a way that Judah would have lost its identity, as northern Israel did. From one perspective then, there would have been no Jewish people to whom the Messiah could be born. Their story would have ended right there. Instead, however, God kept hope alive. All right, Dr. Gain, we've got 5 minutes and some change, and somehow we've got to get through the phenomenal story of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was told by God, you are going to die. He said, oh, no, no, please give me extra time. God did. He gave him some additional years. It didn't all work out well. How did Hezekiah lose an incredible opportunity to glorify God and point the Babylonians to him? So we know the story. The Babylonians came down to visit Jerusalem. Hezekiah said, oh, great to see you. I'd love to show you my stuff. And he showed them the treasure houses and the storehouses and the wealth and the bounty and the plenty. The prophet Isaiah had to deliver the very stern news to King Hezekiah that he had been a fool and that the Babylonians would be back. For why would they not? They did come back eventually. Walk us through this. What got inside Hezekiah's head? What should he have done? Why did God allow this rather stern justice? Walk me through this. We've got about 4 minutes.
Okay, first of all, the context. In verse 6 of chapter 38, it says, God says, I will deliver you and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria and will defend the city. So this is out of chronological order with the previous chapters, 36 and 37, which are about this deliverance from Sennacherib. This is before that happened. So that it was a very serious situation. Assyria, the threat of all of this, and now the king of Judah was going to die from this sickness. And he prays to God, no, don't let this happen. This is a disaster. And God answered his prayer. Now, interestingly, the sign that Hezekiah asked for was for the sun to go back on the dial of Ahaz. Remember, Ahaz was the faithless king who had not wanted a sign. And Hezekiah asked for a sign. And so God did give him the sign. And the sun did go back on the dial of Ahaz. But when the sun goes back, it affects the whole world, right? And the Babylonians were very keen astronomers and astrologers. And in fact, their star charts, which they made in clay tablets, have been tested by astronomers. And they're extremely accurate to today. We can turn history back and see where stars were, just like in a planetarium. They could turn the history back, right? And you can see what the sky would have looked like a long time ago. Well, when the sun did this and something happened, the Babylonians, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then they heard that Hezekiah was sick, and they heard that he got well, and that this had something to do with it. And at this time, it was Merodach Baladan who was the king of Babylon. So he wanted to defeat Assyria. He knew that Hezekiah also wanted to defeat Assyria. Wouldn't he be a great ally if he's so powerful and his God is so powerful that he can even affect the cosmos like this, the sun? What could he do to Assyria? So he's the perfect ally. So Merodach-Baladan sends these envoys over there to get friendly with Hezekiah. Now, what Hezekiah should have done is what Solomon did when the Queen of Sheba came to visit, gave glory to God, and the Queen of Sheba ends up giving glory to God. God is so great. He's given you all this wealth, this prosperity. And you can see the message of Deuteronomy 4, where God says, if you're faithful to my commandments, You're going to be blessed. The nations are going to say, how wise and understanding is this people? And as a result, they would glorify God. But instead of doing that, instead of doing what he should have, he just showed him all of his wealth. Now, why is this story here out of sequence? Why isn't this chapter before the siege of Sennacherib? There's a good reason, because this leads into the theme of Babylon. Because at the very end of chapter 39, when Isaiah came to speak to Hezekiah, the message came from the Lord that because you've done this, there's going to be an exile. Those Babylonians are going to remember all that treasure. They're going to come back and get it. They're going to take it to Babylon. Now, it doesn't depict the full horror of a full destruction. There would be some kind of exile, just your family and so on and so forth. It wouldn't be necessarily the whole nation. Later on, the nation sinned more, and so it got worse and worse, and the exile turned out to be much greater than what's predicted. But right here at the end of the first section of Isaiah, 1 to 39, we have this prophecy of exile. And then chapters 40 and following are dealing with God's comfort, assuring them the nation is going to continue in the future after the Babylonian exile. So it's a very, very important thing for the structure of the book. Now, a lot of scholars, because Cyrus is predicted in the later part of the book of Isaiah, 44, 28 and following, they say that must have been written by a later author. Isaiah 40 to 66 is second Isaiah, a different anonymous author. It's not Isaiah of Jerusalem. And they even say that 66 is a third Isaiah. But I've seen the Isaiah scroll, the great Isaiah scroll, in the shrine of the book at the Israel Museum from the Dead Sea Scrolls from about the time of Christ or even a little bit before. I've seen the place where the chapter goes from chapter 39, the scroll goes from chapter 39 to chapter 40, and there is no division there. There's no indication that the book of Isaiah was anything but one book. There was a prophecy of Babylon in the future, restoration from Babylon, and Cyrus being the deliverer.
Dr. Gane, thank you. This has been a tremendous study. We've looked at some good stuff. We've left a lot on the table, but it gives us a whole lot to continue to press on with. Next time, we will be here with lesson number 8, Comfort My People. Thank you so much. Thank you again to Dr. Gane from the Andrews University Theological Seminary. We'll look forward to seeing you again for more next time on Sabbath School, brought to you by It Is Written.